I try not to make my commentary time relevant, and unfortunately, this one is because we're talking about when things just came out. But it's a cool one,
Sure,
and it's
well, you
out
know,
there in
certain
your orgs right now.
people love hot off the press, and so there's a good nod to subscribe, right, on your favorite podcast platform to make sure you get the latest show when it comes
Yes.
out, so you can get that timely and timeless information.
Oh.
Hello and welcome to Salesforce Trails and Trials, where two Salesforce architects and special guests share their wins and woes so that you can learn with us.
Hey, Eric, you're looking very studious today.
Well, I've chosen my library background to make it look studious.
Wow, I feel like you're smarter already, and I think people are just going to validate that as they listen to today's show.
It's actually just marketing. It's wrapping paper on whatever I am. So it's just presentation skills. It's nothing
Oh.
about the substance.
Well, we'll see. We'll see.
I went through that this week with my daughter. She had a science project for school or whatever. She had to make pyramids, and she made the pyramid, but the presentation wasn't great. So all we had to do was clean up the lines, put a little sand on the cardboard with some glue. Paint some birds in the sky. I found a font on the internet for hieroglyphs. And
Ooh,
so
nice.
I printed out some strips of hieroglyphs because she can't print out strips of hieroglyphs. And then I cut them with an X-Acto knife. So we made a little border frame around, she glued it on. I was the materials provider. But it was all about like, you just got to put polish on stuff, which is not what I did the first time we recorded our YouTube session. I was unpolished that first time. So I'm stepping up now.
It's very nice. And you know, I remember those science projects, and they always had like back to school night like the next week, which was like, are we just marketing for you? Is that what's going on here? Especially it was at a private school. So they're all like, look at all these projects that all the parents, I mean, kids did. Aren't they great?
Yeah, some of those I remember to this day. This girl in my class, her mom was an art teacher. She always had the best projects. We did a planet solar system project. Who knew you could buy styrofoam balls somewhere to make perfectly spherical planets? I had to use a balloon and put paper mache on it and paint it, and they weren't spherical. And you know, this girl's present her thing was so much better. And then you know how there's an asteroid belt around Mars? She took a toothbrush and dipped it in white paint and spattered white paint in a circle around, near Mars's orbit. So there was this beautiful fog of asteroids. What technique does any fifth grader know how to do that? Her
Exactly.
mom
It's
did a good job
amazing.
on that one.
Yeah. And I always wonder, like, you go in and you immediately see the one that's like, oh, look, there's laser cut wood on that one. And like, oh, look over there, there's a, you know, it, his was on electricity, you know, and he's using like a 2 amp battery. You know, you're just like, yeah, probably not. But nice try.
Yes, it's very hard to let your kid turn something in when you know it has to look like theirs. You know
Yes.
you could do better. It's not a reflection of you, but you know they're not trying as well as hard as they
That's
could.
what's hard. Yes, that's what's hard. Well, good. It's great to be together and excited for this new episode. So let's jump into what we learned lately. And looks like you have something that relates to the recent acquisition that Salesforce made that's on everybody's mind at Dreamforce this year. So share your small bit.
Slack. Have we heard about Slack yet? So Slack is I'm seeing more and more. We're talking about Slack being the engagement layer for Salesforce. And it's sort of confusing some people because until this point, Lightning was the engagement layer for Salesforce. But what Slack is actually engagement layer for everything. It's not just Salesforce. It's I don't know. You use ServiceNow, it's an engagement layer for ServiceNow. You want to use, I don't know, whatever, calendars and Google and whatever tools you use. There's some out-of-the-box integrations, and then you can build custom integrations. And so what happened at Dreamforce was one of the things we talked about was we're building a new API, a new framework to make it way easier to build custom Slack apps for to engage with Salesforce from Slack. There are some pilots out right now on sales and service use cases that you can sign up for. And I've been helping some of my customers check those out. But what's most interesting to me is, but what if I want to do something custom? What if I want to do something different? What if I want to do a knowledge search from Slack, mm-hmm. like if an HR ticketing use case or whatever, how do I do that? And the short story is you have to configure Slack to have an app. Then you have to write some code and then you have to host it somewhere like Heroku or Amazon or whatever. And then also that code has to then figure out how to log in as you into your mm-hmm. Salesforce environment and stay connected. And so there's a bunch of complexity in making that work. And mm-hmm. it was cool to read this blog post. And there was a session out, which I frankly still haven't watched. I've watched the whole thing on Salesforce Plus, our new cable channel. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to learn and see actually how easy it's getting, or it will be, stay tuned, to just say, you know, I need a new app that does X. I want to pop up a screen when I type slash Scooby-Doo. And the Scooby-Doo app is going to come up and it's going to query, ask me for information. And then when I hit the return button, it's going to go do something in Salesforce. And I'm not going to have to, as a developer, code much. I'm just going to be able to connect to the back end and I will be helped out by the platform. So that's what I've been learning about lately. I got more I'll talk about later and what I'm excited about. It's more Slack. And it's more about Slack and how Slack is affecting me. So mm-hmm. That's what I learned lately.
Super cool. Well, I read one post from that there's the potential of not there yet, but creating flows, much like we have visual flows on record pages, that we might have a visual flow be able to be invoked from Slack and be able to create that form fill experience on Slack.
Yeah, that could happen. I haven't seen that. I do know. I mean, some people don't know. When you create a flow, it can run outside your Salesforce instance. I mean, mm-hmm. basically ends up, you can be unauthenticated and access a flow. And we see that a lot in our demos when we help people do scheduling of appointments using Salesforce mm-hmm. Scheduler. There are some flows we use to demo that. Flows can also be accessed via inbound API calls. You just hit them like a REST endpoint and pass over a JSON payload of whatever the input variables are. Mm-hmm. And then it goes and does its stuff. So that's almost like an IoT use case where mm-hmm. you're sending stuff in a flow. So my point is, flow definitely is accessible outside your Salesforce instance, and you can iframe it into anything. And I don't know if Slack is ready for that yet, but I see, yeah, that's definitely a possibility.
That's cool. Good stuff. So I think, yeah, for me, it's back to, recently we did two field service projects that were for very, very similar companies, you know, companies that work in the construction industry, and they have specific kind of jobs. They need to do inspections. They are doing surveys and different things. And what we found is that both of them had these the field service was handling the dispatching and the work orders and all of that. But once the service, think about the service report, this is the part that kind of demonstrates, here's all the stuff we did, Mr. Customer, and here's how much it cost, that those rules are not super trivial. It's not like selling widgets to people and saying, oh yeah, you got one of these, two of those, $5 here, $20 there. There's a lot of permutations of those rules. It's a labor project, right? So it's a work order. They're going on site. So we always have a 4-hour minimum. Did we meet the minimum or not? And if we did, what if we did two work orders at the same site on the same day with two different crews? Well, we only want to charge the minimum once.
Interesting.
And what if we have a labor price, but we have an apprentice who is providing the labor at that particular work order? Well, we want to charge 50% of the rate for the apprentice.
Step one is if they can get all their rules down, that is step one.
Yes.
Like, and the technology might not even be the hard part.
It's true. Yes. And that goes back to illustrating a decision tree, right? Which was a little small thing on Miro, which I really appreciated, which is learning, seeing their decision tree, little widget. But they probably had about 60 of those rules. And to figure out, we have to learn or discern what the output of those rules are before we actually fill in and create the work order line items that then produce the service report to show the customer.
Okay.
And so it was the two-part process. The learning for us was, as you mentioned, guiding the client through, all right, let's try and normalize some of these rules because humans are great at ad hoc exceptions. Computers, not so much. Yes. We need to have something that's a little predictable, yes, and actually very predictable, and leverages the data in the system to be able to make the decision, mm-hmm, right? Interrogates the data, as we call it. And then secondly, how do we put that so that by the time they complete the work order, that we can process the work order, create the work order lines, get the right pricing, associate the right products. This includes products consumed as well. Sometimes we charge, sometimes we don't. And ultimately then have it ready within what, 20 seconds? So that they can display the service report to the customer at the point of business and be able to talk through line by line in a way that is, you know, responsible and authoritative. So that was a very, huh?
So what'd you do?
Well, we documented all the rules, of course, you know, in a workbook, and then we ended up using a custom metadata set of objects to kind of keep track of the various thresholds, mm-hmm, and permutational kind of conditions. And then we use Flow, of course, to evaluate those conditions when they relate to a particular instance, right?
Cool.
So we leveraged essentially kind of an asynchronous process after the work order was put to a specific stage to then go back, evaluate, run it up against the rules that related to it in the custom metadata, make changes to the record, and ultimately then move it to the final stage because we're done processing it. And from there, then they were able to create their service report.
Very cool. So speaking of flows, I just demoed this today to a customer. There's a new orchestrator that's like a flow combiner. And you'll find it in the new flow menu. Click in the all templates area and scroll down a little bit and you'll find a new orchestration button. And orchestrator lets you take, in the demo I had, 30 different flows. Some are behind the scenes. Some are require user input.
Mm-hmm.
And you can create stages of your process. And each stage has one or more steps. Every step is a workflow with input and output conditions and maybe a user it's mapped to. And so the orchestrator will do as much automated work as you assign it. But then also some of these stages have work that you're going to farm out to different people. The scenario I'm working with is, you know, it's a solar installation company and they need to do a roof check and an electric check. And so there's a bunch of things that are checked using call outs. Flow will do call outs to your, mm-hmm, systems, bring the data in, check it, move it to the next step if all is well. If something isn't well, it bounces out to somebody else for review. And then it will get to a stage where we need to do these roof checks and it spawns two separate workflow or flows assigned to users. So they have to go do the work. And when they finish the work, then the stage completes and it moves forward. So stick that in your hat and check it out later. But that's a new feature. It just came out in beta this week. And
I see it in my org. I had no idea. I haven't read the release notes in this area yet. And it launched it. So there's auto launched and record triggered orchestration. Mm-hmm. And that looks amazing. One of the elements that this I think is going to solve is if you have a flow, I mean, we've had some flows that have like over 100 different steps inside there. Different. Uh-huh. I mean, and there's really no way to in the old flow builder, there was a markup, like you could actually leave notes and things like that. It wasn't highly utilized. So they just omitted it from the new flow builder.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really something that's missing is if you think about like there's certain conditions where this whole section of the flow relates and you don't really know that at the outset. So Orchestrator looks like it's going to help solve that by kind of sequestering each of these areas to certain criteria or certain themes. Oh,
yeah, it makes it much clearer to read the flow and find out like you're in the house, or the roof approved section. You're in the applicant rejection section. And you can also, there's something called rerouting commands, rerouting, mm-hmm, directives, where if you get to a branch where you need to skip out of your current branch and go to a different branch of the flow, you just put an indicator that you should reroute to either a certain decision point or a certain stage, which has multiple steps. And unlike a Visio diagram where there'd be a line going across the canvas, there's no line. We just tell you the name of what it's going to, and your canvas stays super clean. And it allows you to, it's like go-to points in code. It's just like, you get to here, up, jump back up to here. And that way you can do looping and you can do, you know, conditional skips to other things. So yeah, it's cool. That's a, I try not to make my commentary time relevant. And unfortunately this one is because we're talking about when things just came out, but it's a cool one.
Sure.
And well, it's out know, there in your orgs right now.
People love hot off the press. And so there's a good nod to subscribe. Right on your favorite podcast platform to make sure you get the latest show when yes. it comes out, so you can get that timely and timeless information. Oh.
Yeah,
very good.
So yeah, right? That's a good one that you did. It's impressive that you did that in Flow. I mean, I think people don't know how much Flow can do, and so you know, what would you say was the stretch? What was hard about doing it in Flow?
Well, I think as you mentioned, like the flow part was probably once you know what to do,
like the rules,
kind of the sequence. Rules. Yeah, the business rules. Uh-huh. It's not rocket science. I think the issue with flow is we had to figure out a way that this could be that it would handle higher volumes of because it's possible, right, that this could happen with many work orders at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, and just being efficient, right? So we don't hit governor limits, right? Using collections.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we have to, you know, kind of leverage collections in advance because we have to query certain potential bits of information. So we might have a collection of 7 or 8 or 20 rows. And then as we dig into the flow, we're going to use one or more of those rows, mm-hmm. but we don't want to run the query inside the loop.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those kind of things from a design pattern standpoint can be challenging, and then just figuring out how you organize it into custom metadata in a way that is easily queryable, right? Kind of in the sequence that it needs to be, but works well.
Cool. I'm censoring myself because there's way more tangents I could take us off.
Yes, no, it's good. Going. And we have lots more shows, right? We are only on show. We're in the low double digits here.
Yes.
So, well, this is good. All right. So let's move on to that one small thing that might have big consequences.
Yeah.
All right. So we're returning back in our prior couple shows. We went to that one small thing that really, you know, created something very positive. Now we're back to that one thing that might have a big consequence. So today we're talking about staying in Salesforce Classic.
Yeah. It's easy. You just don't have to do anything.
Right. It's like, it's familiar.
It don't have to learn anything new.
Yeah, it loads fast on my computer. Right? I get those little hover menus that even though they brought those into Lightning as quick links, it's, you know, I just like it. So, yeah, it's comfortable, totally. And then, you know, even in setup, right, I just don't like my objects all combined, you know, my custom and standard objects. I like those sequestered and segregated, you know.
As a tangent, I don't even use the menu in setup. I just go to the search. I don't even know where to find
it. It doesn't even matter anymore.
Doesn't even matter.
That's the beautiful part, is it doesn't matter.
Anyways, keep going.
So yes, we're talking about the impact. So I can say one thing. The way that I no pun intended here, the way that I frame what is Lightning to people is first I have the caveat that okay, Lightning by itself might seem like window dressing. You know, it's new colors, more modern charts. You get those in Classic anyway on your dashboards. But the way I look at it is that, you know, if Classic is like your favorite family photo, then Lightning is like your favorite photo now in a beautiful set of matte and frame. So it just makes it better. It makes it look better and function better because now you have things like dynamic forms, you have things like, you know, your Lightning actions, you have secondary navigation. So from a user experience standpoint, it really helps to, with the priority of information. Well, you don't get all of that when you just stay in Classic. And when you stay in Classic as a leader, you leave all of that potential opportunity for growth and for onboarding and for adoption and for ease of use all on the table, because everybody often follows your example and just continues doing what the boss does, and the vernacular and the support infrastructure and all the training and everything in the organization continues to have the weight of that legacy that is just not generally being invested in by Salesforce, in my understanding.
It's not. I mean, we're not changing Classic, and a lot of new features we're releasing are coming out in Lightning, and we're not making them fit, you know, back into the old UI. There's a bunch of obstacles though to people moving. So, you know, let's say people did a bunch of VisualForce pages. There's two reasons that you don't want to move. One is you're so busy and you think it's not worth it and you don't see the ROI or what the point is of making the move. It's disorienting to users, blah, blah, blah. Another one is, but I have a bunch of custom VisualForce pages and now I have to go do work to make those work as Lightning pages or Lightning components now. So what do you say to those?
Two things. I think that hopefully your VisualForce, as you are making it, you are using the Lightning design system to essentially create your UI for you. It accelerates the process.
Lightning design system to make it look like Salesforce.
Right. And so essentially you're making VisualForce pages that are not going to be obsolete when you move into Lightning.
So that's look and feel.
Yeah, that's look and feel. And for people who have a lot of others, you know, a lot of they don't do that, you can still use your VisualForce pages in Lightning in some measure. They might have to be a standalone page. But I think ultimately, right, from what I heard, right, there were over a billion VisualForce pages. I mean, I think last year at Dreamforce, they said some number. I mean, it was just huge. And they're like, we're not stopping support of VisualForce anytime soon. There is a massive outlay of VisualForce. So you can still access that VisualForce from Lightning and just slowly make the, as you go and modify and modernize some of those, the business logic, et cetera, while you do it, either apply the Lightning design system to it or just convert it over to use Lightning components and or Flow. Visual Flow, a lot of what people use VisualForce for years ago, you can now do in Wizards. Flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's just no need to do it in a programmatic way. You can do now in a configurable way.
Yeah. I would add also, I'm pretty sure you could take your VisualForce page that you wrote and you don't have to change the apex part that much. You have to decorate the apex with something called Aura enabled, or there's some little, you know, at sign that you put above the functions to make them accessible in your Lightning web components. And then your UI component, if you want to convert it to Lightning, you can either wrap your VisualForce page in a Lightning wrapper. So you're doing bare minimum. What you're losing when you do that is responsiveness. So your widget is always going to be 600 pixels wide
or whatever it is.
If it's in VisualForce. And that was the flaw of VisualForce, because when VisualForce came out, nobody was mobile. There was no iPhone. And there was no need. We had Blackberries. We had Blackberries.
Exactly. Blackberries, blueberries, and raspberries.
Nobody was thinking about putting your same screen on your browser, but then the iPhone came out and responsiveness is a thing. And so the world changed and we had to change to Lightning. So that all changed. So that's one thing you're losing if you just do the wrapper technique. And I would say also, people are afraid to turn on Lightning. You can at least turn it on for your admins and give them the possibility to flip back and forth and then explore, as maybe, you know, some of my customers spend 20% of their time on technical debt and just, you know, chip away at those pages. And like, you know, at least don't ignore the tunnel that is Lightning. Have access to both, you know, paths and flip back and forth. And, you know, attack your VisualForce pages bit by bit. And I think you'll find that the apex doesn't need much changing and just the UI needs changing. And the apex is probably the harder part for most of it. So yeah, you got to learn, you know, Lightning web components. But I don't know. It's staying, you're not going to get a bunch of things on Lightning. And also, sell me on why Lightning's better. You said secondary, what do you call tabs? Secondary engagement?
Secondary navigation.
Secondary, what is that?
So you have at the, if you think about, I'm thinking in the context of a console. So to me, Lightning, and to your point, I actually think that someone saying switch to Lightning just because is not sufficient. Mm-hmm. Like there really needs to be a business case that like Lightning enables me to do something better. It's not just because it's just a better mousetrap.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
It needs to have real business value. And I recommend executives look for that and they demand that and say, look, what does Lightning give me? Because Lightning in and of itself is not sufficient for me to move.
Totally.
Right. So to answer your question of you asked me,
why would I move to Lightning? Responsiveness would be one. I said, mentioned secondary navigation.
Well, I think that there are general use cases and then there are specific use cases. So I'd say another element of the general use case is it unlocks like tremendous usability gains where the expectations of your users already are. So your users are already using Amazon and Facebook and you know various consumer-based websites. Okay, so these have dimensions that Lightning has, right? So they have not only the responsiveness element, but they have a lot of interactivity like signaling and toasts and like things that help me with kind of error handling and making sure my forms are done well. They're dynamic. They are also thinking through things like in-app guidance, right? Where they provide me insight into changes or help in context of where I am, right? And you only have access to that in Lightning. They also provide this kind of in the function of a console. So to me, Lightning is all about the console and like using my, you know, in Classic along the top, you have your tabs. Those are all of your objects. Well, it's largely a waste of space because now if I want to deal with multiple records at the same time, which is like normal life, like everybody does. Now I have to have browser tabs to do that, which uses more RAM and makes my, you know, kind of put some strain on my computer and then also makes navigation a little more challenging. So now the console brings and says, look, let's consolidate all that, all those record tabs that you rarely use into one pick list. And now we have record tabs along the top. They're called workspace tabs in the console. And I have first and second level workspace tabs. And then I have
an account tab. And then within the
account, if I click on a contact opportunity, exactly.
Yeah. So your context is all in one tab.
Absolutely. And then the third element is if I'm looking at an opportunity, I can now move my products over into a second level nav, which is a tab component in Lightning, which is much more readable because now I can see all 10 fields for my product line items rather than only two or three in my little sidebar or in Classic, I have to scroll all the way down to the bottom to see that or like use my hover menus, which have the touch targets on those are so small that a lot of people struggle with keeping that thing, you know, visible when they want it. So I think it just, it erases a lot of, or it avoids a lot of struggle and frustration that people have with Salesforce. And it starts to bring to the forefront, like all the things that they can do with this data rather than just consuming the data and being able to read it well, which Classic does pretty good. It now enables that, but also now enables all of the outcomes that people can do, the jumping off points with the data. It makes that more clear with the in-app guidance, kind of highlights what has changed. And that's contextual. It can show me only the first two times I see the record and then it disappears. Yeah. So from a user experience and change management perspective, Lightning provides a ton more capability for people to use.
So you're basically saying you can, I mean, one thing you didn't mention, I think, is new features are going into Lightning.
Correct.
So by not being on Lightning, you're paying the same for Salesforce.
But you're getting a diminishing value.
Features.
Yes.
The other is the screens are more dynamic, richer, more dynamic, you know, they adjust more to what your users need depending on what they need when. That's something that maybe happens a little out of the box, but you can configure it as an admin.
For sure. Not to mention the consistency between the mobile environment, like the mobile experience and the desktop experience, right? There's a lot of commonality there.
Yeah.
And one more thing I'll mention is that a specific feature like looking at a list view and having either a little chart on the list view or a Kanban view. That Kanban view on a list view for opportunities, for tasks, for onboarding custom objects. I mean, like people use that Kanban view all the time. And that to me is almost would be worth the price of admission to Lightning by itself on how many different ways you can use it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the other thing I've been through about a year and a half ago, I can't remember now, maybe 2 years ago, maybe before this whole, pandemic thing. It was actually just last year. I did a deep dive with a customer in a call center who wanted page load times to be 3 seconds when you pop a case. And when we first rolled out their POC, it was 7 seconds. And early on the project, I looked at their project plan and they said, how's this look? And I said, this looks good, except you're going to need 3 weeks at the end of tuning. You're going to need to, you're going to get what you think you need. And then you're going to say, I want it to be 3 seconds. And now we got to figure out, how do we make this 3 seconds? And the tricks are basically with JavaScript, your browser runs faster on a faster computer, number one. So if you're on Citrix, Lightning is more demanding on Citrix servers. So it can be slower if you are using your same old Citrix provisioning setup when you move to Lightning. The other is some related lists are slower than others. And so you can move those off onto different tabs.
And they don't load when you initially load the page.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and the thing is, people, when they first log into Salesforce, it takes 4 seconds for the little seasonal icon to load and then for it finally to load. And people go like, oh, that's slow. We know that that page is slow because we're loading the whole Lightning library for a whole session right then. But then every click after that is very lightweight. Click, 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 open new record, open new
record. That's a key difference between Classic and Lightning. Exactly. Classic is server side. Yeah, Lightning is client side. Yeah.
So summary there, Lightning generally should be faster overall on average.
Yeah, that's a misnomer, right? Most people don't think that. They think it's slower because it might take the computer a little longer to draw the page, especially initially.
Yeah. Those are my thoughts. So those are things on why you should move to Lightning. Those are the problems with why just one small thing, if you stay off Lightning, it's like, it's too bad.
Well, and I can just tell you from the consulting side, like, we don't really like working with companies who just want to stay on Lightning because as we look to solve problems for their users, it becomes more and more difficult to actually solve the problem. It's like saying, listen, I want you to cut down all the trees back here, but the only tools I'm going to let you use are this wrench, this screwdriver, and this fork.
Right.
You're like, I can't cut down any trees with any of those tools. I'm sorry. I'm not going to work with you. It's just the way it is. Right.
Yeah. So I think most people are moving over. Some of my customers, it's just for whatever reason, one of my customers years ago built their whole UI from scratch because they were very proud of their brand and they wanted green opportunity screens. And that's just the way it had to be. And you could do that. And unfortunately they did that and it didn't last very long, maybe a couple of years, 3 years. And then they realized, man, we coded everything. Now I need a coder. I'm not getting my return on Salesforce for being configurable. So anyways, I'm sure we've all heard that story. There's probably therapy groups for that.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of things to avoid there. Staying on Classic can have big implications. And so we recommend you not do it. So let's talk about what we're excited about. Right.
Yeah.
So I think, I think what I mentioned was, that you talked about your integration with Slack. I'm really excited about, I like many millennials, I'm Gen X, but I heard many millennials, they really like a instant messenger kind of interface to their CRM. Yeah. That's what they prefer. And I love using Slack, and we all use those little, Jiffy and whatever it might be. Right. And I just am excited about leveraging all the benefits of Flow that we talked about earlier into a Slack interface. So we can think about creating onboarding wizards for new accounts where I can have one slash command. And at the time, I mean, think about like I have a financial services client right now. And so they need to create in this process of onboarding a new investor group, they have to create a new investor group account. They have to create the contacts for that account. They have to create the contact for the new investor. They have to create the investment account. They have to create the fund. They have to do all of this. And I love this, the typical Salesforce model of like simple and slow. right? Using the UI, it's effective, it's scalable, it's accessible, but it's slow. So the idea of having a slash command that says new group and basically walking people through a simple flow in Slack that basically creates all of the data and the relationships and everything behind the scenes and says, we're done, and gives them a link to go to their account and they can see everything. That is amazing.
Totally.
Right. And it leverages all of the existing Salesforce, the validation rules, all of the platform automation. It leverages all of the, you know, data model that I've already created, right? It just basically creates this nice piping in of, and I just think it's more palatable for people. They love that. So I'm excited about digging into that more.
Yeah.
As it matures.
So in Slack, they talked, the terminology we're using, I talked about engagement layer before. The terminology we're using is there's thick work and there's thin work. And the thin work is the quick little, I need to create a new investment group. It's data entry of 15 fields. Mm-hmm. Click save. Just optimize that for me. Make it fast and easy. Mm-hmm. Let me do that. You know, that's thin work. The thick work would be, let me read a paper and analyze it, or let me cross-reference records and do more research, or let me actually build a marketing journey. You know, that's, you're always going to do that in the original app. Mm-hmm. You know, building a new, you know,
yeah, like build out reports, you know.
Yeah, or in Workday, an employee hierarchy, there's definitely stuff you're not going to do in Slack. But for little things like that, that are, you know, point, frequently used, frequently updated type mm-hmm. data sets, common processes, that's a perfect example. I had an idea last week or this week, about 2 weeks ago, whatever, that wouldn't it be great to take all the data from Salesforce, from the change data capture feature, which is basically every time you change any record in Salesforce, it spits out a little event. Mm-hmm. What if you captured all those events, stored them in a big object, and did some analysis and made a heat map of, show me for my org per object, what do people edit most often? And mm-hmm. in opportunities, it's probably next steps, close date, amount, and stage.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I know that like the Slack team uses a plugin for Slack and Salesforce called troops.ai.
Mm-hmm.
And Troops has actually an app building interface where they know how to log into Salesforce. They also know how to log into Teams. So if you need Teams and Slack integration, Troops does that too. And actionable buttons that say up opportunity right from within Slack. And you get to choose as an admin which fields are on the update screen. So the sales team at Slack uses Salesforce, but they almost never log into the Salesforce UI. They just do a slash command like slash Salesforce, and they pull up the opportunity with, I don't know, company X. And then they see the opportunity, and then they can click on update opportunity, and it prompts it. Troops.ai also has a workflow system in the background, a bot that's pushing reminders to reps. Hey, this opportunity is out of date. Close date is in the past, but opportunity is still open. Do you want to update it now? Click yes. It pops open the necessary fields. You click save. Your boss didn't have to tap you on the shoulder. The bot did it for him or her. And so my point is, there are fields across account, case, opportunity, lead, whatever, that are the most frequently updated fields. And if we know what they are, and CDC would tell us that, we can go just create little Slack apps that help our reps for these processes. And we can discover quickly what are, we can ask focus questions to our reps. Hey, when do you go update stage? Hey, when do you go update next steps? How often do you have to do that? And that I think is the path towards figuring out what are the Slack apps that we need for my company, for your company, for our companies. Everybody's going to be different. So
no, that's very good. And CDC there is change data capture.
Yes.
Not the health services group.
That's right. It is it's a platform events feature that you can subscribe to pretty much for free, I think, as long as you're writing a trigger or a flow. Yeah. What I'm excited about as well is about Slack. And for me, it's this sort of this growth that I've gone through in the last 3 weeks of, you know, I've been a Salesforce setup menu configurer for a long time. I know some Heroku. That was part of the portfolio products I would present. but I never really had to do a project on Heroku. There's been this thing called Node that's been out there for years, but I never had to use it because all I needed to know for my job was things on the Salesforce platform, and I wasn't a Node developer on Heroku. And with Slack apps basically have the Slack client locally. There's a Slack cloud app. You have to run your slash command is actually running on a Heroku or AWS, probably Node or Java or whatever you wrote it in. And then it has to connect to Salesforce. So you've got these other platforms and they're integrating, and it's hard to know, are they passing information correctly in the right JSON format to each other? Because they're talking to each other. How can I intercept that message? So I've had to learn a bunch of things lately. I've had to get smart on Heroku again, so I can push my apps. I've written some Slack slash command apps just to see how they work. I start with a GitHub repo, as one should. Start with that and get dangerous, and then get creative later on. And I've had to learn about tools like, I don't know, I never had to run Node locally. So I got that running. It's all stuff that so many developers are like, dude, welcome to 2012. Well, you know, I was doing something else in 2012 and until now, and you were too. So I'm just learning some other domain. So it's been really cool to sharpen up, you know, working with, I'm a contributor on a couple of GitHub repos now related to Slack. And I just kind of feel like a bit of more of a hacker, and I know I'm doing things that not everybody can do. And it makes me feel smarter, and it's not easy. There's a lot of reading, a lot of learning, a lot of toe stubbing. Like as you break it, you don't know how it works. You don't know why it's broken. You're stuck on a bug. But as I was telling you earlier, as we were warming up for the show, I feel, I don't know, there's a lot more brain activity going on in my head this past couple of weeks. I'm more invigorated because of the learning. I figured out years ago, learning is what keeps me positive.
Yeah,
I love learning. And this has been learning. It's learning for work, which is always a benefit because it lets me do what is invigorating for a work purpose. And it's like a win-win situation. So what I'm excited about is the opportunity to have some time to learn something new and make me relevant for the future.
I love it. Well, so there's more evidence that your library background isn't just window dressing.
Okay. Thank you.
Nice. All right, well, let's talk. That's a great transition to something, a noteworthy thing that inspires us, right? Like, what are we inspired by? And I think that in your example, it highlights, it's actually an example of what I would say is what's inspiring to me is, you know, business has been really good this year. And I think part of it is that we've said yes, you know, we found some good opportunities and we said yes and stretched ourselves a little bit, both in some of the types of projects that we're taking, as well as in a little bit of the volume of projects that we've taken. And, you know, so the way I would phrase that is that, you know, there's a phrase, right, that opportunity is at your door. But in my opinion, it doesn't always knock. Sometimes it's there and you have to open the door and invite it in. Sometimes you have to convince it to come in and maybe you have to convince other people in the room to let it in, right? Like there's a whole set of considerations around that, and opportunity doesn't always knock, but it's often always there. And that's been a good realization, and that's inspiring because it's just worked out. I mean, this has been a tremendous year. I'm so grateful that through the pandemic that we saw no impact. In fact, we saw growth. And much like Salesforce, right? I mean, when the digital demand came around, right? You need help. You need architects. You need people who can help you curate what's important, what's not, and how to get you that acceleration and time to value. So I've been really been grateful for that. And so that's something that has been very exciting to see the opportunity that was just essentially there. And I made some phone calls and reached out and kind of uncovered some great partners. And so it's been a really fun year, lots of learning, as you mentioned, and just lots of impact with users and trying to look at that kind of people first perspective and leveraging Salesforce for cultural, positive cultural change and, you know, well beyond just being a software product to bring efficiency. So that's been inspiring.
We talked last time about when your boss asks you to do something that's a stretch, do it, because your boss has already decided in her or his mind
You can do it.
That you, so that is opportunity knocking at your door and walking in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's this, you know, and you're talking about how opportunity doesn't always knock. And I was saying to my daughter this week, I forget what I was, I was talking about something with a class project, or she wants to be a student of the month. And I said, how do you do that? She says, I don't know. And I said, well, you know, you could go to the principal and say, I want to be student of the month. And
how do I do that?
And how do I do that? And I'm sure she, as a teenager, preteen, she's going like, oh my God, that'd be so embarrassing. I can never do that. But right there, that positions you for student of the month.
Totally. Period.
And you, and I said to her, when I was about 17, I realized that if you don't ask for something, you have a much less chance of it happening than if you ask for something. And I don't know, 5, 10 significant times in my life, I dared to ask for something and I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And it, these were positive turns in my life. I got to work at the supercomputer center at UC San Diego when I was in college because my professor in one of my classes worked there. And I just went to him afterwards and said, can I work for you? You know? And he says, well, follow up with me afterwards. And so I did. I loved being able to work there. And there are other examples too. But so, you know, this is, you have to go open the door sometimes, or put it out there, or pick a door and open it and yell, hey, is there luck out there?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it might not be there.
Totally. I mean, another couple examples, this is fun. These anecdotes, I think that they'll be very realistic for people as they think of their own. So one example of, is, you know, having to knock is I worked at Pasadena City College years ago. This is right when I was at the beginning of my transition. I was in my first year of college. I wanted to go 2 years to a city college and then figure out what I wanted to do. And I already knew about the internet, right? So I kind of always, I was already into websites. This was like 1996. And so I got this gig. They opened up a computer cafe. Okay. So listeners, you got to remember, all right, 1996, most people don't own a computer.
There was no Wi-Fi.
There's no Wi-Fi. There's no iPhone. Basically,
they have email.
They do have email. Yeah, but your email address is like 247575@compuserve.net, right? Yes. and so
that's the way it was, and you just liked it.
And you just liked it, exactly. And they were, and you were on Good Morning America, and they're talking about the at sign. Have you guys ever used the at sign?
Yes.
Mm. So, anyways, I got this job. They had these computer cafes were opening up, and Kinko's, which was the predecessor to the FedEx office of today, they had computers that you could rent for $12 an hour because nobody owned them, but you still had assignments. So colleges were beginning to have assignments for, you know, you got to type up your stuff. Just like, I mean, that goes way back, but anyways, they wanted to compete and say, look, we'll create our own computer lab here at the school and we'll only charge $4 an hour. And that'll be much more accessible to the students. So I heard about it. And so I was like, well, I want to go into computers. That's a good place to learn. I can help people, whatever. And so I applied. I was the 29th person of the 29 hired. And so I got the absolute best hours, you know, something like 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. and like 12 p.m. to 6 a.m., right? I got pulled over numerous times walking to school with my long hair, just checking to see if like, did you have any spray paint in your backpack? I'm no, go ahead and check. It's cool. Whatever. But while I was there, I learned a ton and I was like, I didn't really like these hours. So I kept going to my boss, a guy named Nino Valmasoy. I really appreciate the opportunity he gave me. And I said, hey boss, I love doing this, but what else can I do to help you make this grow? How can I help this be known for more students? You know, how can we make this opportunity fulfill what the school wants it to be? And he would say like, that's a good idea. Why don't you do an employee handbook? Why don't you put up a website for us? You know, why don't you do scheduled training where you can teach someone how to use Microsoft Excel, you know, and people can show up and that'll show people the value. And it was a Mac and PC lab too. So I was able to teach and learn both Apple and, you know, Windows NT and all of that. And I just kept asking. So he's like, yeah, you can set your own hours for this semester because now you're like the manager in there. And I just kept asking, what else can I do? What else can I do? Mm-hmm. He ended up sharing my name with another group on campus, which had three other computer labs. And I actually displaced GE Capital folks and just manage their, you know, doing their IT work, like fixing the computers or whatever. So it was a win-win because I was a lot cheaper than GE Capital guys.
Right.
But it was a great learning opportunity and I could go in at any time. So I got my first taste of working not based on a schedule and being available, but working based on deliverables. When a computer's broken, I go fix it overnight and it's ready the next day for the students. And that's why I got paid. I was an insurance policy. My life has never been the same since I got a taste of that kind of work environment, because that's what I turned everything into in the future. I'm just an insurance policy and it doesn't matter how available I am. I want to be valuable and the value I deliver is what people are paying for. So anyways, that's just cool. My experience and it all started.
And you kept asking.
I kept asking.
Yeah,
exactly. I'll give a funny story about where it knocked. Okay. So I had a Matrix fan site back in the day. I went and watched The Matrix and I was like, dude, this is a cool movie, Matrix 1. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I should do The Matrix online. So I went and I bought The Matrix online. And I bought a bunch of others. At the time we had Palm. You remember Palm Pilots?
Yeah.
All right. I loved Palm Pilots. So I went and bought it. I reserved a bunch of those domains too, because you didn't have to buy them back then. You could reserve them for 6 months from Network Solutions, right? So I got like Palm, Palm Source, Ping Palm, Napalm. You know, they weren't all very smart, but I was reserving, right? It cost me nothing. So I got an email. It's one summer, like, you know, just saying like, hey, my client has agreed to pay $2,000 for palmsource.com. And I thought it was a joke. I thought it was like my buddy sending me a note or whatever. And remember, I just reserved them. I didn't even buy them. By this point, it's been more than 6 months. Somebody could go buy it for themselves for $85, right? So I responded to the email and I was like, oh, okay, thank you. You know, our going US rate for domain names is $3,000. And they responded back and said, okay. So I went and I reserved the domain name for $75 and I sold it for $3,000. It's like the best turnaround I've ever had. And what I just thought about was like, I responded to the email for one, like it knocked, right? And I just recognized an opportunity that I'm going to be, they're going to pay me for convenience and I'll happily provide the convenience. So there's both examples there. And I think it's important for us to look back, as you said, that there's inflection points in our life that come out of us responding to opportunity. But honestly, you get a lot more opportunity if you ask for it, if you open the door and look, right? Like there's an old axiom that says, don't be surprised if luck follows the prepared. And I think that in that scenario, when you open the door and you're prepared for that opportunity and you're looking for it, you will find a lot more of it because people love helping people who are hungry for opportunity. Like your professor, Eric, you want to work here? I love people wanting to work here. I'll figure it out for you.
And that, you know, you said luck, opportunity, preparedness in the same sentence, and something that, I don't know, my dad told me like back and I was in college or whatever. And he said, luck is at the intersection of opportunity and preparedness. And that's the phrase. So opportunity happens. Oh, holy crap. I'm prepared. I'm so lucky. I, you know, I got to go work in France for Accenture for a year in Paris when I was 26. And I was prepared and that I already knew the product that the project needed in France. And I told my boss, hey, if you ever hear about a French project, I want to go. And I already speak French. So I'm double prepared. An opportunity just came by. Hey, we can't find anybody with these skills. Does anybody have this background? Oh yeah, I got a guy. He speaks French and he has his background. And I was lucky to go live in France for 10 months. And one I heard recently from through my brother was, and I swear we talked about it on the podcast. Did we? But I can't find it in our notes. Did we talk about luck surface area?
Yeah, you did. The guy in Pasadena who came up with that, right? Another podcast. Yeah, but was
that, did we put that in the podcast?
No.
I don't know if we did. Anyway,
I don't think we did.
Increasing your luck surface area. And the idea there is, imagine that luck is a, you can catch luck. The surface area that you can use to catch luck is a function of how much you know, how prepared you are, And also, how many people know that you are prepared?
Hmm.
I think
what you know and how you're communicating that, how you're making it visible and valuable.
Yeah. So if you put it out there that you know Node and Flow and whatever, Salesforce, and also French, and also something else, now your net has all these dimensions that could be catching luck as it comes by. So this other guy, I think it was some podcaster, maybe it was Texing. Is that, mm-hmm. do you listen to Texing?
No.
So I think it was him talking about increasing his luck surface area by publishing articles and just putting it out there on GitHub, putting it out there on LinkedIn, whatever. You're just expanding your luck surface area. And whether you're talking about luck surface area at work, or if you are somebody like you who you need a brand outside your company, mm-hmm. you are doing it. You have this podcast, you're presenting on different podcasts, you're increasing your luck surface area. So the quote that I've been living by forever is luck is at the opportunity of intersection of opportunity and preparedness.
Yeah.
Just go learn something. You never know when it might be useful. And then, you know, that's one that I want to bring up.
Yeah. And I love it. And you can do it. I think I love what the example you gave earlier too, is that you don't have to be this boisterous, extrovert, loud person to do this. Like by learning something and, for example, contributing to a GitHub repo on this topic, like you're doing that. You're just proving that you know something and you're communicating and making that valuable by contributing to that repo. So all the other contributors and followers of that repo now recognize that you know this and that you've contributed and you've added value. And so that's a great way that people who maybe don't want to be so, you know, outspoken and visible like we do, that's another way they can do it quietly, but yet very effectively. So that's wonderful. Yeah. Well, good. It's been a wonderful show. I hope everybody has benefited from this. We look forward to your ideas. If you want to reach out and make any suggestions, you can reach out to Eric at
EYEWELL.
That's on Twitter. And I am John Kline, JONCLINE on Twitter. And please subscribe, share with your friends, and we look forward to connecting with you in the future.
See ya.